Welcome back to the second hour of Guitar Tracks. I'm your host, Brian Tarquin. Tonight I have the great pleasure of sitting down with Joe Satriani again for his new album, The Elephants of Mars. And it's a killer track, and it's a killer album. So Joe starts out on how he got involved with this new project.
Thank you. It's been so wonderful to be able to release new music. You know, it's hard enough to make an album, to get it manufactured, released, and then go on tour and explain it. You know, the actual making of the album, there were benefits to everybody being at home and working privately, because everyone could spend so much more time on their performances. And this, I think, made for a really unique record. Certainly, you know, it's got my best playing on it, and that's because I wasn't rushed by a budget or a calendar date or clock on the wall, you know. So, I mean, it's quite a story. When I look back at it, it's like everybody's life, you know, going back to the beginning of 2020, it's everyone is switching from plan B to plan C and trying to figure out a new way of doing things while they're taking care of themselves and their families and their friends and everything. So, but basically, quick history lesson is 2019, out with Doug Pinnick and Kenny Aronoff, we're doing the Experience Hendrix tours. And during that period, I record Shapeshifting with Kenny at Jim Scott's studio, along with Eric Kodia and Chris Chaney, Christopher Guest, a few other people. And, we deliver the record, get it mastered right at the beginning, like January 2nd, I think, of 2020. I go to LA. I make the video with ZZ for the song 1980. I play on stage with Steve I twice at the end of January, early February. And then those become our last performances as solo artists, pre-pandemic. And when I get back to San Francisco, lockdowns start. And so we had to make that difficult decision whether or not to hold the album or release it. And I had a sinking feeling that this wasn't going to be a 3-month or 6-month delay. So I asked Sony, let's just go ahead and release it. People need music. It's my job. You know, I can't make vaccines or... You know, I'm not a doctor, but this is what I do, so that I should do it. You know, we released the record. We couldn't tour behind it. We did another video, remotely again. And then I started thinking about recording two albums that would be giveaway records for when we did finally hit the road. And I kept thinking 6 or 9 months away. When that changed, I scuttled those plans and I thought, I bet the next time that I come out on stage, people are going to expect something new. And so I should dream up something entirely new. So what do I want to do? So I said, okay, let's write better songs, come up with better arrangements, play better guitar, get more interesting guitar sounds, put together a team that is down with all that stuff. And let's see if we can make the best record in the catalog. So, a crazy thing to do when you've got a schedule and you're under the gun and you've only got so much money, you know, a small budget to run into a studio and make an album. But I didn't have that. Actually, I had kind of a weird, unfortunate carte blanche, right? I had all the time in the world, and everybody on my team had a way of recording themselves. Everybody had a home studio to some degree that wouldn't stop them from contributing to the album. So I reached out to Brian Beller for bass and Kenny, of course, on drums. I got my longtime friend and coworker Eric Kodia to play a little bit on the record. And we got a new keyboard player, Ray Thistlethwaite from Australia, to contribute, even though he was on tour in Australia the whole time. It was really a fantastic journey creatively. If I separated from the tragedy of the pandemic, it was a beautiful experience. To be able to immerse myself so deeply in a creative project.
It's very interesting because a lot of artists became reclusive and really created some wonderful pieces of work during this pandemic. Now Joe goes on to explain stylistically what he was going for musically for the album.
I didn't want to limit myself to any kind of stylistic direction. I'd done that before quite a bit and really enjoyed it. You know, I think going back to the Extremist record, which was, you know, my pointed thank you to the classic rock era that I missed just by a few years because I was too young, and I really wanted to make a classic rock sounding album. And, you know, when you do that, you have to eliminate things so as not to confuse the stylistic issue, you know. And but it helps because it keeps you on track. You know, small things like, you know, this guitar sound makes sense. You know, don't use, you know, avant-garde or heavy metal sounds. They don't fit with classic rock. Or, you know, it's okay to use dobros, banjos, harmonicas because fit with classic rock, you know. So there, it really does help. But and I think I kind of did that again with Shapeshifting and What Happens Next, the two previous records. And I really loved them, and they really brought me to some new places, and I got to have fun with Chad Smith and, you know, all the musicians that contributed and sort of came on board with that idea in mind. But I, you know, when I started to brainstorm the Elephants of Mars, I thought, you know what, I am done with these parameters. I'm not going to say I'm going to do an EDM record or a reggae record or a blues record. I'm not going to say anything myself that might stop me from writing something interesting. So it was wide open, and I wrote maybe 20, 30 songs before I got around to whittling it down to, let's say, 16. And then we weren't really sure. I think we did about 16 or 17, actually, you know, like 90%, until I started to think, okay, these two, maybe some other album. And we got down to 14. And, you know, you can always make it 10. You know, your management will always argue, do it 10. Don't give the record company anything more than, you know, they deserve. But, you know, I'm an album artist. I like making albums for my fans. I don't really expect much in the marketplace. And so I don't have to play by those rules. I don't, you know, release singles for years prior to release of an album compilation. And we certainly don't have budgets for, you know, big videos that we would release for, you know, five songs, you know, leading up to the release of an album. So the plus side of that is that I'm left alone to dream up whatever I like, and no one really bothers me. Enjoyed that freedom. I enjoyed it with Sony for many years, and now with Ear Music, they've extended the same, you know, courtesy of artistic freedom. And so, I didn't know that what I was going to make in terms of the overall style of the album until we settled on the 14. And I think Eric and I sat back and went like, wow, look what we did. We don't know what it is. We don't know what we're going to call it stylistically, but we like it. You know, we respond to the eclectic nature of the album.
That's funny, because I always thought the best relationship between an artist and a label is a distant one where they leave you alone to create. Joe now explains his move to a new label, leaving Sony, and also new mixes for Surfing with the Alien coming soon.
Well, the transition was really long, because that contract started in 1989, and it had ended technically over a decade ago, and I was in this extended option period. So every 2 years, I would call my managers and say, you know, are they going to, you know, take me up on that option or not, you know, or do we have to go look for another deal? And, you know, right at the end, at the last moment, they'd say, oh, I guess we'll take you up on that option, you know, and all of a sudden I'd have a budget for another album. So I go, great, you know, great team there at Sony. However, towards the end there, the last couple of records, actually the last album, I wound up with nobody from the last like 30 years working with me. They'd all either retired, gotten fired, or moved on to other parts of the industry. I think there was only one guy, maybe it was Scott Carter, who was my production manager, maybe for one record many years ago, and he'd moved to some other area of the label. But I mean, it was literally just all new people. I was the old guy at the label. I thought, oh boy, you know, here we are. It's the end of the, it's finally, there are no more options left. And, you know, they made an offer to just re-sign me. And I just thought, well, I don't know anybody there anymore. And I'd known Max at Ear Music for over 10 years because we met when he took on the Chickenfoot catalog worldwide outside the U.S. So I had a relationship with Max Vaccaro at Ear Music. And we really did see eye to eye, you know, about the kind of music we liked and the kind of albums we liked. And wouldn't it be great if these kinds of albums were still made? So it kind of made sense to give Max a call and see if he was interested. And he was, and we were able to come to an agreement about what kind of a, you know, future I could have with Ear Music, with the kind of stuff that I do. So that was great. It was very, the transition was easy. I still am partners with Sony in terms of my catalog, which is extensive, as you can imagine. We're actually kind of working on an Atmos remix of Surfing with the Alien right now. So it's kind of exciting. An interesting thing that's happening with these mixes. And I think that, you know, you don't want to not be included in some new technology, but you don't want to rush out there too soon as well. Because, you know, I've been listening to music and I've been a consumer for so many years, I can wave a red flag and say, hey, remember Quad? Remember 5-to-1? Remember 7-to-1? You know, it's, you know, or SACD, you know, there's like all these formats that as an artist, I had to pay for, and they're gone, you know, and stereo has ruled. When an artist is going to spend their hard-earned future money on mixing, you know, an album, they want it to go to the best possible format that's, you know, going to make economic sense as well as make sense to the way people listen to music. And so that's been stereo for the longest time. People still listen to music on headphones. You only got two ears. So that makes sense to us. When we go in and make a record, you know, there might be tens of thousands of dollars in the budget that are just earmarked for that mixing period. If somebody comes along and says, oh, by the way, you know, we'd like 7-to-1, 9-to-1, 11-to-1, you realize you're just multiplying your budget and suddenly there's no money. You know, I mean, it's serious. It's a serious problem for musicians. So when this comes along, you really want to say, hold on a minute now. How are you going to help me out with this? And are you certain that people are really going to listen? The way that we look at it is that we have an opportunity and a budget from Sony to remix the album for some kind of Atmos format. There's a little bit of sort of like Atmos wars going on right now. You know, it's like there's about maybe four different formats. And it the problem is that most people who have Atmos systems at home don't actually have real Atmos systems. What they have is two speakers and they have a sound bar. And then so the software in the player decides how to emulate that whole Atmos multi-speaker experience. But it's not really what the artist is mixing. It's some sort of electronic brain is saying, okay, I'm going to put this over here, put that over there. And it always sounds weird, you know, when you leave it up to the chip. This doesn't sound right. There's a term called fold down, where it's very often these things get mixed. And then, you know, there's literally a button you push that takes your Atmos mix or your 7 mix, and it folds it down into stereo. And that also sounds really weird. It just doesn't make any sense. But very often, there's no extra money for an artist to simply mix the record again. All they're trying to do is have a product to put on the shelf that has stereo and Atmos and whatever else they come up with, you know. So they're going to make money on it eventually, but the artist won't make any money until the debt is paid off. You can enter into a period of servitude that you may never get out of. I've been keen on being careful about that. I've always been, in the black with Sony, and so we've had a great relationship, and they've understood that I think pop artists can risk it a little bit more, you know, because when they have a success, it's wild. You know, it's just wild success. Artists like myself, you know, we're never, you know, we're not thinking there's going to be a hit single. We're not going to get 23 billion streams on one song. You know, it's just, it's not really part of the genre that I'm in that that's going to happen. So we have to be a little bit more careful with the kind of money we put into creating these pieces. However, I love the idea of offering my fans a really tasty audio treat, you know? So as I said before, I love working with Sony because they came to the table saying, yeah, Surfing with the Alien and Atmos, obviously we got to do it. So let's figure out how to do it. So we'll do the mix. And but when the mix is done, we'll figure out what is the current format that looks like it's going to survive. It's kind of like VHS versus Betamax. Crazy because, you know, that album's old. It was done on tape. And, you know, luckily, John Cuniverti, my co-producer and engineer on that album, has been meticulously maintaining those very old tapes. And so we made 96K transfers years ago. Tape, you know, I'm not sure we can play the multi-tracks anymore. We've baked them twice, many transfers to salvage it. We could put that tape on the machine and it might just fall apart. So, but luckily, we have really great 96K files to work from, but there's stuff they need to prepare because Atmos is quite revealing, you know. You know, the album doesn't have that much information on it. There's a drum kit, a bass guitar, two rhythm guitars, a melody, and so it was all done on 24 tracks, so that's really only 23 tracks of information. There are all sorts of funny things in when you record on tape that allow you to obfuscate some different issues with the medium, but once it goes to Atmos Digital, suddenly everything is revealed. There's no curtain behind. You can hide behind. Every track is available to stand all on its own in its own speaker, so you have to make sure everything's really clean and isn't distracting because it's got some sort of tape noise on it, you know. That album was done. I mean, this is a side note, but a very interesting side note. It was recorded straight analog, but when we mixed it to the latest thing back then in 87, which was Dolby SR. Beautiful sounding. When we brought that to Bernie Grumman for mastering, he was fascinated by it, but he had never done one. So I remember we spent an hour trying to hook the damn thing up. I think this is right. And I was thinking, oh, this is not inspiring confidence, but he did a wonderful job, and that's what made the album so quiet and yet had that beautiful analog depth. That was a funny risk that we took back then because we hated the hiss and we loved quiet moments with the electric guitar, which, you know, they go hand in hand with hiss. What I have found is that the noise removing software, once it really totally removes noise, it has eaten into the signal that you want. And so, you know, once a song starts, the sound of a guy playing his drums is going to cover up 90% of hiss and things like that that come from a guitar or a bass track. And so we're not too worried about that. I think it's just like a song like Midnight, just that clean guitar plugged direct. You know, there's just inherent noise from the tape, not from anything else, just the tape itself. You know, there's been so many decades between when that record was recorded and now, and people have headphones that are more revealing than we've ever had in the history of sound reproduction. So, you know, we have to keep up with the times so that, you know, these little anomalies don't distract people from enjoying the music.
That sounds like an exciting new project. And I know what he means because I have a lot of analog 2-inch tape that will fall apart if I play it. Now Joe explains how he came up with the title track, The Elephants of Mars, and what kind of devices he used to record it.
You know, it started with a noise that turned into a real sound and a real part on a song. And I immediately thought, wow, that sounds like some kind of giant space elephant, you know. And one thing led to another, and I thought, well, what if there was such a thing? How would it come to being? Where would it be? And, you know, the next moment I'm thinking, okay, it's the future. And Scientists here on Earth have figured out a way to terraform Mars. It goes very well. 100 years down the line, what they forgot was that they may have created some other things. And one of those was these gigantic sentient elephants that communicate telepathically, not only amongst each other, but apparently among the colonists that have been working on Mars for the corporations of Earth. And they get together and decide, you know what, Mars should be a free planet. No more working for giant corporations of Earth that just want to use us for raw materials. So they launch a revolution to take back Mars and make it an independent planet. Believe it or not, this is exactly what ran through my head. I called my writing partner, Ned Evett. We have a company called Satchtoons, and you know, we came up with the Crystal Planet comic book series, and we've got a lot of stories that are under development. And I ran it by him, and he fleshed out the story a little bit more. So I was able to lay that whole story on the band and say, guess what? This is what this song is about. So use it as, you know, artistic license to, you know, go crazy with your performances. And it really worked as a way of inspiring everybody right to the end to let the song be really funny and crazy and sci-fi like. Long Guitar Solo at the end was very, it was unplanned. That's one live performance. And, you know, I was plugging into something I'd never plugged into before. And it's just one of those things that happens when you have a real story to bounce off of. All the guitar parts were all recorded direct, and all the guitars you hear were made with one plugin, which was the original Avid Stansamp plugin. This was a real surprise to me because I really did plan on using all my amps here at home, and I was going to, you know, then as the album was getting ready to mix, I figured pandemic would be over, we'd go into a studio and reamp everything into real amps and, you know, put up microphones and record it traditionally. But when that didn't happen, I started to reamp them at home. But eventually, we all kept picking the Stansamp track as our favorite sounding track. Clean rhythm or a super distorted solo. More Joe, you know, per square inch than any other modeling suite or actual, you know, reamp recording. Really surprised us because I hadn't planned it that way. So in the case of the title track, I recorded the guitar almost the exact same way, which is I always plug directly into Millennia Media HV37 mic pre that has a low impedance input in the front. And I go directly to Pro Tools and I monitor with Stansamp. In this particular case, I went into a Palmer signal splitter to give me left and right out. And one went directly into the HV37 and right into Pro Tools. And the other one, an Electro-Onyx Micro Qtron, a funky little envelope pedal. And what I found was that it doesn't really stay 100%. It's actually pretty unreliable, but in a really fun way. So as I was performing it, I noticed that the sound would be in stereo, and then all of a sudden it wouldn't, and then it would, and then it wouldn't, then it would. You know, it just like, it was just acting erratically, and I found that to be very inspiring. So I just kept playing and playing and playing, and then this session file that Eric had created for me was sort of extra long, just so I could explore, and I found that all of a sudden the end came, and I had performed this long piece, and when I listened back, I thought, well, that should be it. That expresses the elephants of Mars charging across the new Martian landscape, you know, more than anything I could have arranged on purpose. So that wound up to be the track. Pedal wise, I used PC Electronics Sub and Up. I used my Vox Wah-Wah, my Big Bad Wah. I used that little Hendrix Octavio. I think that was about it. And then everything else, you know, like flangers and choruses and delays were all, you know, just separate plugins and outboard gear. I wasn't able to attend the mixes. So, you know, I would basically just wait 24 hours and then I get a mix at, you know, 8 a.m. Those guys were down at John's studio. They'd start work at 10 p.m. and they'd go to 8 a.m, you know, and I'd wake up at 8 a.m. and there'd be something in my inbox. It had to be done that way. There was no other way to really accomplish it. But wow, what a fantastic way to record and to get such an unusual result. You know, for me, it was really great not to be subject to ridicule by my friends every time I made a mistake, you know, and I found that kind of humorous because I realized that the last record we did, so much of the recording was live in the room, that when I heard the tracks back, I thought, throw caution to the wind, Joe, you know, guitar player. But you don't really want to do that when you're in a room with a bunch of people and everyone's trying really hard to play their parts correctly so that they don't screw up the take. And so I thought, well, okay, I've done that record a million times. Like, we should, you know, we should take advantage of the fact that you can, first of all, you can do 1,000 takes and don't worry about screwing up because no one's in the room to remind you, you know, which, you know, it's all in good fun, but still it has an effect. And then the other thing is that this is a funny thing actually, is that if there's like 3 or 4 people in the room when you're doing a solo and you notice that, you know, people smile or nod their head when you do something, you're going to do it again. You know, it's just the nature of being a performer that you play to the room, whatever the room might be, you know. And when there's nobody in the room, you really do have to please yourself. And that's a whole other dynamic that takes over. And I really enjoyed that. And I found that I was harder on myself than, you know, working with an engineer producer in the room. And I also relaxed a lot more, you know, didn't feel self-conscious to get silly or over emotional or just to chase down a technical thing that was difficult for hours and hours and days until I got it right. So overall, it was a positive outcome from recording that way all by myself.
Yes, I have to agree with Joe. My best work is in the studio when I'm by myself. Now he explains how he composed the first single, Sahara, from the album.
Composing for me has always been pretty much the same, which is I get overwhelmed with an inspiration. It could be something very intellectual or totally emotional or just a physical feeling. It could be something really dark and scary or just really happy. Could be difficult or it could be something so simple, like I feel great. You know, like a song like Bluefoot Groovy is just about feeling great. Song like Pumpin', kind of same thing. They're both songs that are more about physically feeling great in the moment. And I write these things down as I start to put these ideas, these inspiration to music, and I stay focused on them, and they help me do that. Just like, you know, the Elephants of Mars, really, you know, you get the sound, you get the title, you get the story, and then you focus on the story, and it allows you to play and to finish writing, keeping that story in mind. So if I'm doing, let's say, a song like Faceless, I knew exactly what the song was going to be about as soon as I started writing the music. Staying focused on that theme allowed me to eliminate that shouldn't be part of the song. I would say that, you know, I'm never going to limit myself to even my own, you know, tried and true methods, because, you know, I'd be the first to admit to you there are no rules, really, and you'd be silly to think that you've perfected. If you think that, then you're just fooling yourself, you know. So it's better just to say, as soon as I feel inspired about something, I'm just going to run with it and discipline myself never to let an idea get away from me. And then you evaluate it later. Here's a perfect example. So I had this overwhelming feeling about a guy who was lost. I came into the studio and I wrote this song and I wrote all the lyrics and I called it Sahara because the guy who was lost might as well have been in the middle of the Sahara Desert. He was so distraught and had no way of getting out of his bad psychological, emotional state, as well as the fact that he found himself lost, but in an urban setting. And so I sent the whole demo to the band, including the lyrics and a track that emulates the singing. But eventually it didn't really work for the band. I don't really know why, but it wound up in the maybe pile, and then it moved over into do not do pile. About a month later, my producer said, I love that song. We got to do that song. Maybe, you know, you should try rewriting it without vocals. So So I just basically had to throw out all the, you know, the melodies of the verses and choruses and come up with something that would reach people instrumentally, because, you know, once you take away the words, the melody sometimes is just weak. So really, when you get down to it, I always give this example to people. Like, I'll say, look, if I had a set of lyrics that started off with these two sentences, which is, my dog jumped out of the watermelon and then abruptly caught fire. I mean, that is such an image. But if you imagine a really good singer, Harry Styles, walking up on stage and saying, my dog jumped out of a watermelon and now he's on fire, you know, his audience is going to be like, oh my God, what happened to the dog? How did it wind up in the watermelon? How did it catch fire? Did you put the fire out? You know? And so that's what a set of lyrics can do. Yeah. So if you removed Harry's lyrics and you played the notes, it wouldn't make any sense at all. So you have to go back and say, okay, if I want them to think about dogs and watermelons, how do I do that with just 12 notes and a guitar, you know? So that's my job. The demo that I made is actually the beginning of the final mix. Obviously, my drum loop is replaced by Kenny Aronoff playing real drums. Eric did a lot of the keyboards. He added oud. He actually played oud and some sort of Turkish instrument. He added a lot of textures. I wound up keeping the original guitar solo and the sort of secondary melody, I guess we call it. There's like two melodies. The breakdown section is from the original demo that, you know, I wanted Ray to sing along with the guitar. So it was really the verse guitar that changed. And then Eric introduced two very interesting compositional ideas, which is in the middle, we created a breakdown and then added some chords, and then we took away some chords, and then he brought back those chords at the very end of the repeated chorus, which was a great idea, which was just a really good writing element that he added to the song. So yeah, that's why I was saying it's about, you know, 65-70% was exactly as I recorded the demo, but there were some intense changes. That last 15% was crucial to making the song work.
Joe is always such a pleasure to speak with. He's so articulate and specific on what he does and how he records and creates. Now, next week, I'll have part two of the same interview. Now, here's the title track, The Elephants of Mars.
This is Joe Satriani, and you're listening to Guitar Tracks on WFIT, home of the best guitar instrumentals. We'll be right back.
That's a great new track by Joe Satriani from his new album, The Elephants of Mars, and that's called Bluefoot Groovy. Before that was the first single, Sahara.